Welcome to our weekly markets update from Chief Investment Officer Sonia Loud and her team here at Legal & General Investment Management. This episode was recorded earlier today and is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to our weekly CIO market update, which we're holding for our clients during this period of volatility brought on by the coronavirus outbreak. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO at LGIM, Howie Lee, Head of ETFs, and Hetal Mehta, Senior European Economist. Now, investor sentiment remains fragile, and there continues to be a tremendous amount of news regarding the spread of COVID-19 for us to digest. Sonia, let's start off where we start off every week. Could you please give us an update on the state of markets and the health of the global economy?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Max, and good morning, everyone. I hope everybody enjoyed the glorious sunshine over the Easter weekend, although obviously in very unusual circumstances. I hope as well that you have received the presentation. As usual, we have updated the slides for the events of the past week. And I will not refer to all of the slides, but it's worth highlighting a few of the main changes. As you can see on slide one, markets are continuing their at least stable but more positive tone. We are looking here at equity markets. The same has been happening across credit markets. So despite the fact that we still get obviously a lot of news flow, mostly negative news flow around the virus development, markets clearly seem to be looking more beyond the disaster that will be the second quarter and look beyond what potentially will happen in the third and the fourth quarter. As before, we obviously spend a lot of time on thinking about when countries will be, passing the peak and will start more looking towards the recovery and then obviously eventually the exit phase, i.e. when will governments be in a position to lift the restrictions that have been put in place. And clearly the last week has seen a lot more talk about governments talking about starting to discuss when restrictions could be lifted. What is clear is that this will be a very, very gradual process. And again, this is something for us to take away because that obviously will have clear economic implications. So what you see here on page two is our attempt to schematically map countries in their journey of COVID-19. And obviously you see very clearly that we have more and more countries moving towards the recovery phase. And as such, clearly governments then, with that happening, taking away the debate to think about restrictions to be eased. As before, as you can see, the final chapter of the COVID-19 development is potentially, at least from a market's point of view, the most important, which will determine how successfully countries will come out of the restrictions and the lockdown measures. And it's how we described it, exit or relapse. And as you recall, this is very well reflected in our economic scenarios as well, because the more successful a country will come out of the lockdown period, the faster the economy can recover, and hence, obviously, the better markets will react to it. But as we have highlighted a couple of times, the biggest risk for markets and the economies, obviously, is that we have a significant relapse after the lifting of restrictions, and that obviously would lead to what we call a W-shaped recovery, because it would force governments to literally put lockdown measures back in place, and hence obviously the economy would literally come to a standstill once more. Now, in trying to assess, how well countries are tracking, as you know, we have started to focus a lot more on the development of death rates rather than new infections, because we felt that new infections are far too unreliable given the measurability and the measurement put in place by governments. We have last week picked up for the first time the fact that emerging markets seem to be the lagging countries in the COVID-19 developments, and that we are obviously watching now very carefully how emerging markets will experience the crisis. Likewise, we're looking a lot more now towards countries that have been the so-called vanguard countries, i.e. the first ones in: China, Japan, Singapore. And you see there on slide three, that actually we have seen in Japan and Singapore in particular quite a dramatic increase in new cases over the recent period. So a lot more to watch, because if I refer back to slide 2, it's very clear that it's these countries that will give us a first snapshot on how successful these governments will be in lifting restrictions and allowing economies to go back to normal. Another point we wanted to raise is on slide 4, because we are tracking the development of death rates, particularly in Europe, to the experience that Wuhan in China had. And you see very clearly that although Italy seems to have reached a plateau and a peak in daily death rates, it is remaining stubbornly high, and it's not declining to an extent we would have expected. And hence, obviously, we're still watching very carefully how the UK and the US will look in comparison. So it's still a lot to watch out for. But for us, most importantly, obviously, is if more and more countries will now try to lift restrictions, what does this do in terms of the economic recovery story? And then obviously linking it back to markets. Does this mean that, you know, markets have been too quick to think about the third and the fourth quarter? And do we have to potentially expect markets to retest the lows of March? As you can see on slide 6, these are our three scenarios, although it's fair to say that the focus currently is squarely on scenario 1 and 2. The main difference between the two is the success of the restriction lifting and as how well countries will literally come off those lockdown periods. And what we have to remember as well is the support markets have received and economies are receiving from policymakers, from central banks and governments. And I think it's worth highlighting a big change between last week and today is the Fed announcing yet more measures. And it's fair to say that the Fed by now probably has the broadest and best equipped support toolkit for literally every market participant. And it was very interesting to see that now even fallen angels will be part of a program. I will spare you all the acronyms. They are by now so plentiful that I'm sure there's sufficient overview and pages to look at this. But this is very important because in a way, the Fed has backstopped financial markets. We have discussed this before, that this is particularly important for fixed income, because here in particular, we have seen quite a big spread tightening on the back of all these measures. But it's clear as well that this is in a way necessary in order for us to see the long-term implications to be mitigated. So with that in mind, obviously, we have two very interesting speakers with me on the call today. Hetal, I think in particular, because Europe obviously has been very much in the center of the COVID-19 developments. And here in particular now with Germany and even some of the other countries debating how to lift restrictions, I think we will get the first taster here. One other element that we obviously have to understand and have to look at is what does this do to budget deficits? You know, how sustainable actually are these fiscal measures that we have seen announced by governments? And although this is not a topic markets will focus on for 2020, it is clearly something that we need to bear in mind in 2021 and beyond. And there was clearly a study yesterday from the Office for Fiscal Sustainability here in the UK that has looked at the plans of the UK government. And just to give you an idea, they do expect second quarter GDP to fall by 35%. And they do expect actually the public sector net borrowing to go up quite a lot and to reach 14% of GDP. So quite big numbers that and we have to bear in mind, and obviously the UK is not the only country, and is something that clearly we will have to look at in far more detail going forward. I will just leave you with our probabilities around scenario 1 and 2, and it's fair to say that in terms of our economic outlook, scenario 1 and 2 might look similar initially, But then obviously it all depends on the second wave of infections and whether new lockdown measures have to be put in place. And so currently it's not quite 50-50, but it's even a bit higher on this on the second scenario. And that is important in understanding on how markets will trend from here, because it seems that markets are looking through and are squarely betting on scenario one to materialize, i.e. governments will be successful in lifting restrictions. And so I think we have to be prepared that this might not necessarily be the case in every country, and hence there might be at least more volatility, if not a bit more downside. Because if you recall the first slide that I've highlighted, you see very clearly that markets already have recovered roughly half of the initial downdraft. And with that, I'm happy to hand over back to Max.
Thank you very much for that update, Sonia. I think we're all gripped by watching how that final chapter in the crisis you just mentioned unfolds. Let's move to Hetal now. Hetal, what do the three main scenarios that Sonia just referred to mean for growth and inflation in the UK and euro area?
Thanks, Max. So I think one thing we as a team have been careful about is point forecasts, given the unprecedented nature of the economic decline. It's very difficult to put precise numbers on this. So even the OBR numbers that Sonia referenced are a scenario rather than a forecast, so we can make different assumptions. I think it's fair to say that within both scenario one and scenario two, Europe will be more adversely affected than a number of other countries. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, I think, the being slightly ahead of the curve in terms of infections means you have less time to learn from other countries and to avoid mistakes that have happened. So Italy in particular obviously was caught completely off guard by this. So the level of lockdown has been more severe in a number of European countries than we've seen elsewhere. And then the other thing is the policy response. And so the fiscal side has been phenomenal across a number of countries, most notably the US in particular. What we've seen from Europe has been reasonable, but certainly it's quite notable that it is less than what we've seen in other countries. And you know, that is in part constrained by the kind of fiscal stance that these countries have, where their debt sustainability is, but also not having the cohesive policy that we have, let's say, for the UK, for example, where you have the Bank of England and the Treasury working in tandem, very coordinated policies. We could call this helicopter money light, effectively. We just don't have that same system in Europe, and that I think that has constrained things. So see, there's been some agreement at the finance minister level in Europe to have a 2% credit line using the European Stability Mechanism. That's still better than nothing, but I would say underwhelming in terms of that kind of debt mutualization or being able to act authoritatively. So that actually makes the downside scenarios more exaggerated. I do think numbers such as 10-15%, maybe 20% are actually all completely reasonable, even in scenario one. And then scenario two as well, we could have a sharper drop, but scenario two is actually worse, more because of the pace of the recovery is slower as well. And I think on the unemployment side, we have to bear in mind that we will see sharp increases in unemployment. But because a number of countries have got short-time working schemes in place, Germany has had one established for a number of years, but the UK has gone and put one in. This should help to stem that rise in unemployment and certainly help the recovery gather pace faster. We can see that in 2008-2009, the German scheme, we saw a sharp increase in the take-up for that short-time working, but the overall unemployment numbers only picked up slightly, and then they recovered very quickly as well. So there is some hope that these schemes can help mitigate the size of the downturn to a very small extent, but much more about the recovery.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Hetal. And let's just stay with those policy responses you discussed just now. You used the word underwhelming. Are the measures likely to prevent lasting damage to a clutch of different industries? We've just seen very bad retail data for the UK, for example.
Yes, I think the honest answer here is that the jury is still out. There will be inevitably some companies that don't make it through this crisis. Those would be the ones that were weakest going into this. But that doesn't mean that all of the output produced by those companies can't be met elsewhere. So let's say a clothing retailer goes bust. That doesn't mean all things equal, people will just buy less clothes. You'll just buy them from somewhere else. I think one thing that we can't quite capture in any economic model is the kind of behavioural side of this. Do people, as a result of such a huge change in the way our lives are working, then change their behaviour? And does that mean that the level of precautionary savings in the years ahead is structurally higher? So those are the things we're thinking about, but I think it's still a bit too early to say. If we're in scenario one, I'd say the level of scarring is close to zero. Scenario two does capture some level of scarring, but yeah, it's really the Great Depression style downturn where that would be most prominent.
Thank you for that analysis, Hetal. Let's turn to Howie now. Howie, what are the biggest takeaways for ETF investors from the recent market turbulence?
Yeah, sure. And good morning, everyone. I think one of the key things to really take away, if you're an existing investor using ETFs or thinking about using ETFs, is that the recent market volatility over the last month or so has actually really tested the financial markets, whether that's the equity markets on its own, but also the use of ETFs. And we haven't seen this kind of volatility since 2008, and ETFs were tested then. The key thing to take away here is that these vehicles, investment vehicles, remained tradable by design. And that's exactly what it should have done. The two things that probably I would like to highlight for investors is that during the higher market volatility that we experienced in March, indeed some spreads quoted on exchange had widened slightly in certain asset classes. And this is to reflect often the market maker's ability to essentially accept the risk of markets falling quickly in a day. I mean, we've seen markets fall a particular stock even fall 5, 10, maybe in excess of 10% a day. But yet the market makers are here quoting at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. or 11 a.m. to buy and sell securities at that present level at any point during the day. And I think, again, this gives investors the ability to buy or sell the portfolios throughout the day, even through those volatile times. So again, it remains tradable, and that's really good to see that ETFs have continued to do what they were supposed to do throughout the volatile period. Now, another point I just wanted to pick up here as well was around some of the media kind of articles of certain asset classes experiencing discounts on ETFs. And this is mainly around the bond markets, but this obviously should not be a surprise for bond managers as well, because what the NAV or the net asset value tends to do versus, let's say, the tradable price on exchange is really highlight the underlying pricing of the bonds. So in a way, the ETFs are providing a real-time price discovery tool for people to assess, well, you know, what is, you know, what are the markets participants willing to transact at? And so, you know, a bond might be, let's say, valued at a certain amount at a single point of the day, but that valuation may be slightly different or maybe quite different over the past few weeks to what the market participants are willing to buy or sell those bonds at. And really, the spreads or the discounts experienced by bond ETFs commonly reflected that. So again, I think the two takeaway points, you know, from investors in ETFs is they remain tradable. Spreads have widened slightly, although have recovered, to reflect the fact that market makers are willing to price them throughout the day so that you can come in and out at any point during the day. And thirdly, those discounts really reflect the spreads seen in the underlying markets.
Thank you, Howie, for that fascinating insight on ETFs, which are still a relatively young investment vehicle. Looking at some of the issues that Hetal just raised, do you think the economic, or does the economic shutdown we're seeing globally affect the way you think about long-term investment trends?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Max. I think if we take a step back as to how we always think about thematic investing, and it's certainly a long-term vision and view that structurally, you know, how we live our lives is going to change. We've always said here at LGIM that, you know, we've got to look at how technology is changing the way that we live our lives, how we consume energy and resources, but also the impact of demographics. And I think, you know, throughout this last month and a half, COVID-19, we've seen our lives fundamentally shift in the way that, you know, we interact with society. And there's certainly a lot more usage and pressure on technological equipment and services. So interestingly, we take a look at what's actually happened in some of these themes that we cover. And currently on the ETF side, you know, we've got eight themes plus others under development. Now, seven of these eight themes outperformed the MSCI World in the first quarter. Now, this is quite interesting because, you know, these are designed generally to be long-term growth portfolios, but yet, you know, they tend to, on average, outperform across these portfolios 5% outperformance of MSCI World in first quarter. And that really comes back to the fact that the long-term demand drivers remain intact. We know that the world is becoming more and more digitalized. We've got every single industry trying to adapt a more digital model, you know, whether that's in the energy sector or the agricultural sector, et cetera. So those structural changes remain intact. But looking specifically at the last kind of month and a half, and also looking at some statistics from Global Data, you know, they've actually highlighted that within the TMT, so the technology, media, and telecom sector, it's actually security storage that they feel that will be least impacted throughout this coronavirus pandemic. And I suppose what's interesting here is, you know, we get a lot of questions around cybersecurity. And for a long time, we've been saying that cyber demand is likely to be less affected by economic cycles, just purely because of the fact that the digitalization of our future is going to continue no matter what. You know, we've got governments who will be continue to be interested in protecting their data and keeping it secure. We've got companies thinking the same way. And actually, over the past month or so, us as individuals are becoming much more aware of that. And in fact, you may have seen in the press that there has indeed been a surge in cybersecurity or phishing emails trying to reach individuals who are pretty much almost always connected at home in order to do work. So, you know, looking at how that's being affected, actually, we're just feeling more of it ourselves on a personal level. And perhaps I'll shine a light in a few other areas where we're getting a lot of questions from investors in some of the themes. You know, on the note of technology, areas of such as cloud computing are feeling less impacted, as well as e-commerce and healthcare. those areas are really showing some resilience, you know, throughout this past quarter and into April. And I think, again, people are starting to recognize and get a feel for, you know, how these newer industries are going to service us in the future. I think e-commerce is a fantastic example. A lot of us have been restricted from going to the supermarkets or to shops to buy things and putting a lot of demand on companies and services like Amazon, Ocado, DHL, and basically logistics companies that are trying to meet the vastly increased demand, you know, for goods and services. So, you know, I think a lot of people are starting to see that as an opportunity. And finally, the other side is healthcare. You know, we've seen probably as a sector, the healthcare and the pharmaceutical sectors being quite resilient as they are pretty much at the forefront of, you know, the pandemic and trying to find solutions there. And so, you know, our focus and investors' focus on long-term themes around, you know, what are the structural changes in society, that remains intact. If anything, I think COVID-19 accelerates the timetable for how these changes are going to be implemented into the new sectors of tomorrow.
Well, thank you, Howie. That's really, really interesting discussion of long-term investment themes in this very short-term environment we've been watching so closely. Let's move back to Sonia now. Sonia, I've got a quick question before we turn to Hethel in our remaining time and then wrap up, and that's about the recent oil supply cuts announced by OPEC Plus. You know, how significant are these cuts in the context of the economic shutdown and the long-term energy transition?
Yeah, I think there's first and foremost a short-term consideration. I think the market told us in a very straightforward way that it thinks it was too little too late. I mean, there's been lots of expectation around these cuts and the agreement. And it's very clear that the demand destruction around COVID-19 outweighs the cuts implemented. So it is not all bad, but I think this is why we have not seen a more pronounced reaction at the spot price. But it's clear that there is a far more that there's more willingness to collaborate and to coordinate, I guess, in the understanding that the longer term demand picture might look quite different from original forecasts. And as such, we're not expecting any further changes in the short term, but I'm sure that they will now get together on a more regular basis to really assess the level of demand destruction and how they can bring the oil market into a better balance.
Thank you, Sonia. And Hethel, our last question before I turn back to Sonia. You touched on debt sustainability very briefly earlier. Italian bond spreads remain under some pressure. How likely is it that the economic crisis we're seeing now develops into a solvency crisis down the line for the euro area?
So that's a trillion euro question, really. I think what we're seeing in the very short term is the countries are going to have to borrow lots more money. They're going to have to issue a lot more debt. Italy in particular, for the reasons I mentioned earlier. But I think where we've seen previous European crises, such as the Greek debt crisis, there was so much focus on debt to GDP, but gradually the European authorities are starting to move towards the concept of gross financing needs. So how much do countries need to roll over in the next year or two in order to just keep the show on the road? And I think there, for most countries, even with a kind of aggressive scenario applied, most countries, I think, are solvent, both in the short term and the medium term. Italy is the one where I think, you know, there's going to be some indigestion in terms of just how much they have to borrow. You know, debt sustainability keeps getting revised by definition. Previously, it was 85%, then 100% of GDP. We know some countries can sustain much larger debt-to-GDP ratios, such as Japan. Other countries, such as Argentina, can default when their debt's only 60%. So it really will depend, particularly for Italy, on the mechanisms that Europe finds to kind of show that in instances of a shock that has been through no economic fault of that country, that they can club together, and whether there is a tolerance for just being able to digest this debt rather than aggressive austerity policies to follow. I mean, that was the mistake of the Great Depression, just tightening of fiscal policy too early, and that was obviously what prolonged Europe's pain after the debt crisis as well. So hopefully policymakers will learn from that, and that will make it easier for Italy to remain solvent.
Right. Thank you, Hetal. Sonia, is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up today's call?
Thank you, Max. Yeah, just a very brief summary, because I think there were lots of very interesting points that both Hetal and Howie made. And would like to really tie together the thoughts we have around markets, because markets, as I said earlier, are really looking through the second quarter and seem to really focus on the recovery. We know that there is risks attached to it, and hence we have to remain very vigilant in assessing how quickly economies can recover. What we heard both from Hetal and Howie as well is it will not be an even recovery. And we have to be very clear in understanding on how countries can come out of this. We have to understand as well that there's long-term changes in our behavior and our consumption patterns, and as such, opportunity sets might change. And I would like to finish that, obviously, the insights we heard from Howie around the thematic investing clearly is an area that we believe will help investors really to get through this period, when in fact overall markets might not look as attractive overall anymore, but there's clearly opportunities that we see that are worth investing in even right now, and that will help to have a more sustainable pattern of performance, because we believe that the underlying structural growth drivers will support these themes in the long run.
Thank you, Sonia. That's a great point on which to end this week's call. I'd like to thank you, Howie and Hetal, your time today, and I'd like to thank our clients for dialing in. If you have any questions that you'd like to put to the panel next week, please let your usual Elgin representative know.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.